Rumsfeld gave a press conference yesterday, and he was asked about the looting. He said, you cannot do everything instantaneously. He added, it's untidy, and freedom's untidy. And free people are free to make mistakes and commit crimes. And basically what you see on the television is scenes of the same statue being gone down over and over again, and worried discussions about the looting. What's going on? They're stealing everything. They're going to harm the economy. Yes, they're poor and so on, but really, this just shows why we have to come in, why the United States has to invade, why there has to be a regime change, because Iraqis, Arabs just aren't capable of running things in their own way. Sometimes it's said openly, like Bernard Lewis, the supposed intellectual who's basically arguing for a holy war against Islam led by the West. Sometimes it's said with just the worried tones of the anchors and their instinctive concern for the sanctity of private property, over and over again worrying about the looting. And obviously, it's understandable why people who have been impoverished for so long, and I'll get back to how and why they were impoverished later on, why they loot. But what I would argue is that the looting began in Iraq in the opening hours of the war. The first act of looting was when British and U.S. commandos went to the oil fields in the south of Iraq with plastic cards prepared for them by British Petroleum, instructing them how to take control of that oil. That was the first objective in the war. That was accomplished in the opening hours. That was the first act of looting in that war. Just yesterday, another act of looting went in the war. The Iraqis surrendered in Kirkuk and Mosul, the main cities in the north. Kirkuk, the other great center of oil production in Iraq. There's an uprising. There's looting in the streets and so on. What did the handful of U.S. troops in the region do? They went straight for the oil fields. 2,000 troops. 2,000 troops. A man named Mayfield, Mayville. A commander of the brigade, 2nd Battalion, 503rd Infantry. He said, we have to do things that assure people that this will not get out of hand. So where did he go? The oil facilities. When you want to send the message, hey, don't screw with the oil, coming here is important. Hey, don't screw with the oil. That's the looting that's going on, right? Where else is looting going on? According to the New York Times yesterday, Halliburton, which we were told was not going to be given special treatment after all, despite their connections to the administration, in a two-year contract they've got to put out oil fires, stands to make $7 billion in profits. $7 billion in profits. If that's not looting, I don't know what is. And who does the U.S. want to put in as its figurehead? None other than convicted looter Ahmed Chalabi, who stole $300 million at a bank in Jordan, was sentenced to 22 years hard labor, had to be smuggled out of the country in the trunk of a car, and has been a fugitive ever since in Jordan. So, you know, they took him around Jordan, of course, when the U.S. military brought him in to the south of Iraq, so in case, because that outstanding warrant is still there. And maybe a regime change in Jordan might rescue Chalabi from any accountability on his part. So another convicted looter moving in. And you know, who else is cashing in on this? None other than who's got the contract to administer the one deep water port in Iraq at Qasr? None other than Stevedoring Services of America, a privately held company in Seattle. Got, what is it, a $3.8 million contract? I don't have it in front of me. Something like that. That company was the driving force in the lockout of the West Coast dock workers last year, and it's notorious for having all kinds of relationships with dictatorial regimes right around the world, whether it's Indonesia, Egypt, and so forth. They were the ones who got the special no-bid contract, for security reasons, you understand, from the U.S. Agency for International Development. So the looting of Iraq is underway. And what you see televised on the streets is penny ante compared to what's coming about to happen. Because what we're seeing unfold here is the seizure of a country under the pretext of disarmament. Remember that? The disarmament of Iraq has begun, as Bush said in the opening hours of the war. Well, hey, anybody remember that? Weapons of mass destruction? Disarmament? What was that all about? Well, Hans Blix, the chief weapons inspector for the United Nations, was asked about that by the leading Spanish newspaper, El País, yesterday. And he said, basically, that there is evidence that this war was planned well in advance. Sometimes this raises doubts about their attitude to the weapons inspections, understated in his kind of bureaucratic way. He said, a very high price in terms of human lives and destruction of the country. And he said, quote, I knew that there were people within the Bush administration who were skeptical and who were working on engineering regime change. In other words, he was used. He was a front man. He knew it all along. Good bureaucrat as he was, he let the thing unfold as it happened. Of course, now there's a new team of weapons inspectors composed of military personnel from the U.S. and Britain. And I'm sure they'll come up with something to justify their thing besides the fertilizer and other agents that they've come up with so far. So what about the liberation? What about people coming out and being happy that Saddam is gone, the statue's being pulled down and so forth? Yes, the statue was pulled down. Yes, many people are happy to see a hated regime go. But it's also clear that there's enormous bitterness and resentment at how and why that was carried out. An instinctive, distrust, if not a distrust earned by the blood of brothers and sisters, husbands and wives and sisters and cousins and everyone else slaughtered in that invasion. Because that's really what's unfolded. And you can see this by just even in the mainstream, utterly pro-war media, even within the tide of pro-war triumphalist propaganda, the honest interviews with people about the situation come through. What people really think about this? A doctor, Sadak al-Mukhtar, said in Baghdad, "Before the war, I did not regard America as my enemy. Now I do. There are military and there are civilians. War should be against the military. Military. America is killing civilians." A man named Hamid Nayama, who was rescued by U.S. forces from a torture chamber. Within hours of being rescued, he gave an interview to the New York Times. He said, "Of course I'm grateful the Americans saved me, but I'm only one of 28 million people in this country. We would not like it if the Americans try to stay here long." Another man, an elderly man named Sultan Mahdi, 75 years old enough to have lived through the semi-colonial regime that the British had set up, put it this way to the reporter, chimed in. "If the Iraqi people loved Saddam Hussein, the American military wouldn't be able to last one day in Iraq. Not one day. We would attack them." And those things, and those accounts go on. From a shopkeeper looking around saying, "Is this your liberation?" To various people being who find themselves just completely shattered by their lives, shattered by this. A small girl named Rawan, 9 months old, was crawling after her family had taken refuge. They went back home. She crawled back to a small oval object and it exploded. It was unexploded ordnance from a cluster bomb. A terrorist weapon, if there ever was one. And her father, Mohammed Suleiman, said, "I'm going to kill America. Not today, after 10 years. And the stories go on and on and on about the people who have had their lives devastated by this. Because what's in store for them? What's happening? What is the regime change that the U.S. has in mind? First of all, the civil administrator named Jay Garner, who's a defense contractor with L3 Communications, who signed a document praising Israel for its restrained handling of the Palestinian Intifada, gives you some idea about his approach to crowd control, is going to be in charge. He's going to report to General Tommy Franks, active military. Who's going to be in charge in the South? Retired General Buck Walters. Who's going to be in charge in the North? A retired General, Bruce Moore. And maybe, just maybe, Barbara Bodine, former ambassador to Yemen, although the Defense Department was, because she's from the State Department, she's a softy, and they want perhaps another general in there as well. And this tripartite division of Iraq, where'd they come up with that? That was how Iraq was administered by the Ottoman Turkish Empire for hundreds of years. So, Shia, yes, you can have your autonomy from the central Baghdad, but you have to go through me, General Buck Walters, noted for my understanding of the plight of the Shias in Iraqi culture. The Kurds, the largest group of people in the world without their own state, you have to go through me, General Bruce Moore, so your autonomy is strictly limited. And it goes on and on. What is the U.S. military trying to do right now? They're trying to go out and recruit police, former police, to bring back, to restore order. Marines installing, they've denied it. They installed a dusk to dawn curfew, and then this morning Brooks was on TV denying it, that they had done such a thing, but they are trying to restore order. And in terms of the military, what have they got going on there? The problem, they had a real problem in the battles in the final hours for Kirkuk and Mosul, because what they were trying to do was to convince the Iraqi commanders of these 100,000 troops to surrender en masse. And he said, you can be the commanders of the new Iraqi army. Come on over and join us. You'll be the new army. Problem was, all the troops deserted and they walked home. Right? Those were the pictures you saw. Didn't work out that way. But don't worry. Some British troops in the south came across a weapons cache, a bunch of abandoned tanks, armored personnel carriers, and things like that. And they said, we'll take control of these pieces of equipment still functioning. It would be a shame not to use that equipment to keep some of the cost of creating a new Iraqi military security force at some point in the future, just like in Afghanistan. This is the best kit available to the Iraqis. So we want to get, bring them back and so on. And who would be the likely candidate to be the commander of this new army? A man named Khosraji. Now, Khosraji might as well be called Chemical Khosraji, like Chemical Ali, because he was the man who was just as much responsible as Chemical Ali or anybody else for the use of gas, poison gas, against the Kurdish uprising towards the end of the Iran-Iraq War in the late 1980s. He is accused of war crimes and is wanted in Europe for those war crimes. And of course, he was kidnapped, quote unquote, by the CIA, rescued, brought to Doha in Qatar to prepare him to move in, and he's being touted by the Pentagon as the next likely head of the army. A war criminal, man who used gas on his own people, right? Who killed his own people. And of course they know him. He's a known quantity, just as all the Iraqi military leadership are known quantity, because during that period, none other than Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense today, it was a special envoy for the Reagan administration, went to Baghdad, met with Saddam Hussein, and made sure that they had all the weaponry they need, chemical and otherwise, in order to launch a war against Iran to try to bleed dry the threat of that the Iranian revolution posed in the region at that time. And really what you're seeing is that the Iraqi regime, having been nurtured by the United States, then used when it went out of bounds, invaded Kuwait back in 1990-91, then became the pretext for an extended, long-term U.S. military intervention in the Gulf, establishing bases in Saudi Arabia, right around the Gulf. And then, of course, why is that so strategic? Because it's a central repository of the world's oil supply, keeping Saddam Hussein in his box, as I said, through sanctions, which were punishing, which killed at least a million people, impoverishing the country, and in fact had the side effect, and this is not unintentional on the part of those imposing the sanctions, of actually re-centralizing control of the regime in Saddam Hussein's hands. Because, after all, when people did rise up, when George Bush Sr. said, rise up and overthrow, they almost got away with it, right? The Shia controlled Basra for a couple of weeks. The Kurds were on the verge of declaring a separate state until the United States began to, until they pulled the plug and allowed Saddam to crush them. Because what they wanted was a regime that they could knock out. They wanted not real liberation, not people emancipating themselves, but actually something that they could impose. And if they could centralize a structure, a rotten mafia-tied structure in which 60% of the population depended on food rationing and so on, they thought that they could knock out the top of that regime and plant in something on top of it. And that's still what they're attempting to do to this day. That's why they're inviting people to come back to work and so on, and why they're so worried about restoring order. And if you really want to get an idea of what happens when they really do encounter liberation, there was a very instructive little article in the New York Times just a couple of days ago about the town of Ansara, in which basically the Marines were approaching this town, and the military simply fled, just walked away and left it. And the corporal approached the town, or the commanding officer, excuse me, a colonel approached the town, and he found himself face to face with a guy who said, "I'm an engineer. We've taken control of the town. I'm a member of the opposition. We're in control of the water supply and the electric supply, and we'd like to work with you administering the town." And the Marine colonel said, "Well, I'm sorry, I really can't help you with that." "Well, we're in control of the town. We'd like to work with you and get food and so on." "No, I'm really sorry. I don't really have anything, you know, to say to you," and so forth. Because they're not interested when people take power for themselves. The elements of popular resistance that emerged during the invasion, as people actually stood up to fight, and people 4,000 people tried to return from Jordan and elsewhere, Iraqis, to try to fight the U.S. invasion. They're not interested in that. They want to suppress that and bring in the people that they've bought and paid for, and that they can install very readily. So that's the nature of this, and according to this, I can't believe this must not be what Kissing's watch must be fast, because this is all by way of introduction to talk about the main topic of the meeting, the Bush Doctrine. And I'll try to go through that quickly, and we come back to the discussion, because really what we're seeing here, this was on, as the NPR journalist put it today, that this is the regime, this, you know, talking about the threats to Syria. And she said, with the doctrine of Bush doctrine of preemptive warfare in full swing, anything is possible now. And I guess, and maybe that's the message. And that is the message. It's a message not just to Syria and Iran, but it's the message to the world. Because what this war was about was, it was a demonstration war, really, because they understood that the Iraqi regime was weak and so on. They understood that they could sweep over it militarily very quickly. They didn't count on the resistance they had, and they're doing their best to that's why you keep seeing the statue fall over and over again, because they don't want you to think about that, the resistance in those opening weeks. They don't want you to think about that. The regime collapsed because this self-interested, parasitic ruling class that simply vaporized under the threat of state vaporized under the threat of invasion. The resistance is there. It's going to remain in a deep wellsprings of nationalist resentment of colonialism, which runs deep in that society, and indeed right through the Middle East. And that's been awakened throughout the region, and it's been awakened more generally in an anti-war movement, which at its high point in terms of one single day demonstration involved at least 10 million people right around the world. And what they're hoping to do in the wave of pro-war triumphalism, in the wave of propaganda, is make you forget about that. Make you question whether you were right or not to oppose this war. They want to do their best to run that photo op, and there'll be others, believe me, they'll come up with more of them, to try to make people believe that they were wrong to oppose this, that really U.S. Military is an agent of liberation and change, so they can get her across the real program, which is, of course, world domination. And if you don't believe me, it's all spelled out for you in the Bush Doctrine. It opens like this: "The great struggles of the 20th century between liberty and totalitarianism ended with a decisive victory for the forces of freedom and a single sustainable model for national success: freedom, democracy, and free enterprise. Today, the United States enjoys a position of unparalleled military strength and great economic and political influence." And they say, in so many, just about so many words, "We intend to keep it that way, prevent the emergence of another strategic rival." And there's really four points to the Bush Doctrine, and it's really what's laid out in the National Security Strategy document, which is published every year, and elaborated in various other announcements, like the use of tactical nuclear weapons, for example, tearing up arms control treaties, and so on. It really boils down to about four points. The first is the preemptive use of U.S. military power, including regime change, and anything that takes, including nuclear weapons. Second, the refusal of Washington to be bound by international treaty or organization. Third, the prevention of the emergence of any strategic rival, whether it's a more consolidated Europe or probably more seriously China. And fourth, the explicit linkage of U.S. economic and military policy. You know, the free trade area of the Americas, NATO, military, it's all one package. And you know, John Bolton, a guy who's the assistant undersecretary of state for arms control, if you believe it or not, says, there is no United Nations. There is an international community that occasionally can be led by the only real power left in the world, and that is the United States. Ken Edelman, who was formerly a chief arms negotiator in the Reagan administration, a guy in charge of stopping World War III, supposedly, he says in an interview, he's the one who originally used the word cakewalk to describe the war in Iraq, and he wrote an opinion piece the other day called Cakewalk Revisited, saying, I was right. He says, the time now calls for drastic measures. Let's have more wars. That's where we're going. And, of course, the framework for all of this was the attacks of September 11th. They have been used by the Bush administration in order to justify an endless war on terror, which, despite the utter lack of evidence, including something testified by the CIA, that they have that they've been able to try to link in the popular consciousness to link between 9/11 and war on Iraq and war on just about anywhere else. According to one opinion poll, almost half the population see some kind of link between Iraq and 9/11, and that is something that's been used to shift into high gear an imperialist project which has been gathering steam for some time. And the word imperialism, which was always seen as this left-wing jargon term, which only people like ISO members would use in public, right, has now been embraced by even mainstream people, and is a good thing. A guy named Michael Ignatieff wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine. The cover said, "The American Empire, get used to it." You know, could that be any more blunt? And a man named Sebastian Mallaby, a columnist for the Washington Post, wrote in Foreign Affairs Magazine, the leading journal of the foreign policy establishment, an article that was given the cover headline of The Virtues of Imperialism. So, you know, when you think about the virtues of imperialism, think about the missile that hit the market in Baghdad, which was described by British journalist Robert Fisk. It was an outrage, an obscenity. The severed hand on the metal door, the swamp of blood and the mud across the road, the human brains inside a garage, the incinerated skeletal remains of an Iraqi mother and her three small children in their still smoldering car. Two missiles from an American jet killed them all. By my estimate, more than 20 Iraqi civilians, torn to pieces before they could be liberated by a nation that had destroyed their lives. That's the benefit, the virtues of imperialism, okay, in the 21st century. And really what we're, the new imperialism is every bit as barbaric as the imperialism that emerged on the world scene a little more than a century ago. And it was analyzed by the Russian revolutionaries of the early 20th century, Lenin, Bukharin, and others, as a fundamentally new phase of capitalism. Capitalism was initially characterized by relatively small companies, you know, going boom and bust. But over a period of time, capital concentrated and centralized into larger and fewer units. And ultimately, they became so large and so powerful that they exerted enormous influence on the actual nation states at which they were based. And of course, this was an era in which much of the world was divided up into colonies. You know, Britain owns this, France owns that, and so forth. And Spain, until the U.S. Managed to break in and grab its share. And that was the driving force of capitalism towards competition and profit, the underlying drive for profit, no matter what the cost. And you see that all the time in terms of people, you know, you're hired on in good times, you're laid off in bad times, no matter what the human cost, whatever's good for the bottom line. That same logic run through the growth of enormous corporations, driving the policy of competing nation states, leads inevitably to war. And that was the argument that the debate about this was taking place on the eve of the First World War. And it was not a unanimous position in the socialist movement. Karl Kautsky, a German socialist who was seen as the Pope of Marxism at the time, said, look, what do you mean that war is inevitable between the great powers? Germany and France, they're so economically integrated, they're right next to each other, they're not going to, Europe is not going to go thrown up into a charnel house of war. We're not, those days are over with. Yes, there might be some wars here and there in the colonial world on the edges of the world system, but that's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. Of course, in August 1914, it did happen. A horrific, all-out, total war, killing 20 million people in the heart of Europe itself, and which led to massive slaughter. And really, it was a war, as Lenin put it, it was a struggle for the division and redivision of the world. And he pointed out and said, look, under capitalism, when there's an imbalance of forces, and when someone starts accumulating economic and political power, and it tries to resolve that economic power, tries to resolve that politically, how's that going to happen? It's going to happen through force. Because German capitalism was trying to rise and expand. It was more dynamic than its rivals in Britain and France. The U.S. was rising at the same time. It exploded into war. And it was a struggle that was not even resolved at that in the First World War. The Second World War was carrying through that same conflict, yet with even greater and even unimaginable horrific consequences. Of course, I'm talking about the Holocaust at this time. Now, in this era, the United States was able to get something like a free, not quite a free ride, but was able to cast itself very differently than its European rivals, because the United States never had a colonial empire in the same sort of way. Obviously, it carved Panama out of Colombia, it held on to Puerto Rico as a colonial possession, and so on, but generally tried to run its empire through its domination of markets rather than actual, direct political control right around the world. And as Trotsky pointed out, the Russian revolutionary Trotsky pointed out in the 20s, he said, when America is compelled to engage in acts of open military criminality, the responsibility in the eyes of U.S. population, and to a certain degree the eyes of mankind as a whole, falls upon all the other citizens of the planet, but not on the USA itself. In other words, we're the forces of liberation. We support a world without colonies. Woodrow Wilson, president during World War I, went to Europe with his 14 points for democracy, a war to end all wars, and so forth. And the U.S. was able to kind of, during the Cold War struggle with the USSR, the U.S. was able to repackage that as a war for freedom versus communist domination. And we in the international socialist tradition never had any illusions in Russia as socialists. Really, you had two mirror systems, a market capitalism in the West centered in Washington and a state capitalist bloc centered in Moscow. But in terms of the propaganda of the day, it allowed the United States to package itself up as a war, as standing for freedom and so on. Now, never, of course, along the way, it sponsored various dictatorships in the Third World to stop, to throw back national liberation movements wherever possible, whether it be in Latin America or Africa and so on. And, of course, the decisive battle for U.S. imperialism was in the 1960s in Vietnam, in which it encountered a national liberation movement centered in the northern half of the country, which had been partitioned after the French colonizers were driven out after the Second World War. And it was there the United States thought it could make a stand and begin to roll back communism, so-called. The problem that the U.S. faced, of course, was that they were not just against Ho Chi Minh, who was portrayed as the Hitler of Asia and so on, and very much the same sort of terms that Saddam Hussein has been described for us today. They were facing a national popular liberation movement to cast off decades and decades of colonialism. And it was because they were fighting a popular war that they could win every battle, but ended up being driven out of the country. Just as the French were driven out of Algeria, the Portuguese were driven out of southern Africa, the British were forced to surrender colonies in Africa, and so forth, because the popular movement for self-determination, for national control, was dominant. And very often, these newly decolonized regimes could look to Russia for support in the Cold War, get a little bit more breathing room that way, often call themselves socialists as well, carry out some popular reforms. Ever since the U.S. was driven out of Vietnam, since that last helicopter left the U.S. Embassy in April 1975, they have been on a drive to wind back that clock, to actually try to claw back that defeat and what its implications were. It's no coincidence. Personalities do count. This is a bipartisan project. I'll come on to that in a minute. But personalities do count. The people who were in power at that time were Rumsfeld, was Secretary of Defense then. Cheney was Chief of Staff under the Ford administration. All these people had to lead the retreat back 28 years ago. Now they want to be the ones leading the charge forward. That's why Rumsfeld is such an articulate spokesman for U.S. world domination. It's bred deep into his bones. And that's been the project ever since. Now, like I said, it is a bipartisan project. It actually began about 10 minutes after the helicopter left in 75. Sometimes they couldn't do anything about it. When Henry Kissinger promised the South African government that U.S. troops would back them in fighting the Angolan revolutionaries, the army said, no, we can't do that because we're not sure which way the black soldiers are going to shoot. So we can't send them to Africa. The army's dysfunctional. It fell apart after Vietnam. We can't do it. It won't fight. It won't fight for what we want it to fight for right now. We have to take a pass this time. So you saw a whole series of proxy steps, whether setting up regimes like the Shah of Iran or Somoza in Nicaragua, and at the same time, an escalation of an arms race. And it was our Nobel Peace Prize winning President Jimmy Carter who signed Presidential Directive 59, which authorized the use of nuclear weapons in a tactical battlefield Third World War to be carried out on the plains of Western Europe. He also was the man responsible for setting up the Rapid Deployment Force, which was the agency that carried out the U.S. intervention against the Iranian Revolution, a failed attempt to rescue hostages and so on. The Rapid Deployment Force is still with us today, although it's now known as Central Command. And it became the model for dividing up the whole rest of the world in a series of commands right around the world. And the U.S. suffered some other setbacks with the Nicaraguan Revolution, the Iranian Revolution, but they've been able to try to work their way around, spending Russia into bankruptcy in the 1980s during with the arms race, at the same time using a series of arming insurgents such as the counter-revolutionaries in Nicaragua, sponsoring reactionary governments wherever possible to try to wind down, squeeze the USSR wherever they possibly could. And then finally the collapse of the USSR opened up whole areas of the world for the penetration of the U.S. economy. And the Gulf War of 1991 allowed a war to take place that would have, a war of that kind would have created the Third World War had the USSR been at the strength it was 10 years earlier, but it was falling apart. It had lost its satellites in Eastern Europe. The U.S. knew that once Saddam Hussein stepped over the line, they had an opportunity that they could take advantage of. But the Cold War left all kinds of messy business. It left Central Asia, Afghanistan, all in chaos, quote unquote. It left the Yugoslav state fell apart into civil war. Lots of loose ends left when the divisions that set up the Cold War fell apart. It left some messy business. So what the U.S. was able to do over the course of the 1990s through the Clinton administration was undertake a program of the militarization of the of foreign policy. And that phrase comes not from me, but a guy named Basevich, who was a retired colonel, Vietnam vet, who was pro-Vietnam War, long-time Cold Warrior, who's just published a book called American Empire, basically saying, what I signed up for was really about freedom and democracy. These people want to go back to the Spanish Civil War and create a new American Empire. And he went through how the whole series of military connections take place between the different commands, you know, CINCOM, PACCOM, you know, all the different names, military links. That's why the United States was able to set up five bases in Central Asia within, what, 2 or 3 weeks after 9/11, because the work had been done there for years. In 1997, the commander of the Marine Corps, a man named Sheehan, flew on the largest, then longest airlift ever from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to Kazakhstan in the heart of the former USSR, parachuted down to a press conference where he said to the assembled media, I would say the message here is that we can go anywhere. And that was the message. And now they are going anywhere and everywhere that they can. And, of course, this was all taking place during the Clinton administration. The Kosovo War was another example of that, to try to use gunboat diplomacy of the old 19th century sign. You know, do it our way, or we'll come after you. If you don't sign up with IMF, World Bank, and the WTO, we've got the NATO to drop bombs on you. That's basically what the package of policies was under the Clinton administration. And, you know, there may be some tactical differences in terms of how to go about it from between the Republicans and the Democrats, but it should be absolutely clear that the Bush doctrine, so-called, really reflects a bipartisan thrust. It reflects the idea that, you know, it might be crude, it might be overdone, the Democrats are better at marketing because they have to sell their programs to workers and so on, but basically they're for the same thing. Look, the U.S. is gained economically. Its share of world production has increased over the last 20 years at the expense of its rivals. But it's got some economic problems. It's got big trade and finance deficits. And really what we need to do now, especially at a time when the economy has been dead in the water for a couple of years, is actually to use our military arm of our strength to consolidate our power and drive it further. And use the military and economic arms, kind of rather than using the economic arm for a long period of time, the military arm for a long period of time, mix them back up like any good boxer does, right? A series of combination punches. And if you want to see how things would be different under a Gore administration, here's Leon Thorth, who was set to be Gore's national security advisor. He said about he was critical of the way they were going about building up for war in Iraq and unilateralism and so on. But he says, when the moment comes, the United States must avoid half measures. Given the changed climate produced by September 11, we should aim from the beginning to destroy the Iraqi regime, root and branch. That is the only way to secure logistically and politically indispensable support we need from the Gulf states. No, how you do it? You scare the hell out of them, and you move in there. You're able to get what you want. That's the man who would have been in charge had Clinton been in. I have to finish. Where does this leave us? There's no question that the U.S. has scored a big military victory. But although, as the Financial Times put it, it's kind of like the victory that Pizarro had in conquering the Incas, where they killed 5,000 people without losing a person. He said maybe it's an exaggeration to compare the two, but not by much. I mean, the U.S. was up against almost nothing. I mean, the Taliban was nothing, and it's incredible how much resistance there was in Iraq. I think it was in spite of the government that ruled that country, not because of it, because people tried to fight back an invader as any way possible. And there's a description of teenagers in Baghdad getting some rocket-pelled grenades trying to take on an A1 Abrams tanks and just being blown to bits and trying to do that. And when people do things like that, they're not motivated because they love Saddam Hussein. They're not doing that because they're motivated by some love of the Ba'athist regime. It's people who have nothing and understand the Americans coming in. Well, I mean, they'll still have nothing and perhaps even less. And there might be some change in faces at the top, but for the majority of people, the structure of that society as it's been will remain the same, and that they want their right to determine their own future. That was what drove some people to fight, people to try to return back. And right now, many things can happen in the north. Turkey could intervene and so on. But for now, the U.S. has been able to revel in its pro-war triumphalism and try to use the momentum to go after the next target, whether it's the low-hanging fruit, as they talked about after the war on terror for September 11th, whether it's Syria or a much tougher potential opponent, Iran. But drive forward they will. And they're quite confident that they have no opposition, because they look back at the wave of anti-colonial, anti-imperialist resistance over the last 30, 40 years, and they say, we crushed some of them militarily, We bludgeoned the rest into accepting, and we bought the rest of them. So who's going to oppose us? We can do whatever we want. And what they don't count on is that people going out, and those kids with an RPG going out there in that tank. And if maybe they did it the wrong way, some people will discover how to organize nationalist resistance. The British found that out after occupying Iraq after the First World War. They found that out the hard way with a massive uprising. And the anti-imperialist sentiment that awakened around the world, and which has actually been organized for some years as a political current coming out of Latin America, especially around the World Social Forum, is not going to go away. There may be confusion and uncertainty about what this means in the short term, but clearly the potential and obviously the urgency of building an anti-imperialist opposition is clear. And unlike the nationalist anti-imperialist regimes to carve out a separate state against the domination of the U.S. Back in the 50s and 60s, is historically a progressive step that was. And obviously, it's not a done deal if the clock can be turned back in Iraq. The struggle for national self-determination is there. But actually, what's going to be key is internationalism. What's going to be key is building solidarity between workers in advanced countries and workers in the countries that have been the targets of imperialism. Because after all, what stake do working people in this country or any other advanced countries have in this? Back in the 60s, they talked about guns and butter. They talked about that some people will have to go off and fight and die for the interests of U.S. Some of them will have to, but that's just the price we have to pay for prosperity and so on. What do we have today? The biggest fiscal crisis in 50 years in the States, massive layoffs, real wages stagnant for nearly 30 years, a rising an unemployment rate, which is officially a joke, which is understates unemployment by underemployment by several millions. Really, it's
the more aggressive turn of U.S. imperialism abroad, the permanent war, wherever the U.S. agenda takes it next, is matched in equal measure by a war on working people at home. And despite all the pro-war propaganda, despite all the flag waving, that can only paper over that reality for a certain period of time. Those contradictions are there. They will come to a head. And I think that's the perspective that we have to have going forward. We have to understand what's taking place here, that this is nothing a lot liberation, nothing to do with freedom. It's a war for oil, conquest, and empire. The character of that war didn't change because 150 people with the help of a tank pulled down a statue. That didn't change the character of that war. That war is a war for empire and conquest, and the evidence is there every single day if you look for it around the barrage of official propaganda that's there. And I think if we take that understanding of that situation, put it in the kind of analysis that I've tried to lay out here today, I think we can begin to lay the basis for carrying out an argument in that what has been an anti-war movement that we don't go home now, but we actually lay the basis for a long-term anti-imperialist movement and socialists because we have an analysis of imperialism as flowing directly from capitalism are always at the heart of the anti-imperialist current within a broader anti-war, anti-militarist movement. And that's really the goal that we in the International Socialist Organization try and set for ourselves. We're just as resolutely against this war and imperialism as this week as we were the week before, and we'll be the weeks ahead. And then sometimes we'll be going out in large demonstrations of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. Sometimes we'll be speaking in meetings of tens and 20s and 30s, having these discussions like these and going through this. Those are not two separate things. They're united in one thread because it's the size of the movement shows that the audience and the hunger for a different kind of war. People are appalled and sickened by this war. They don't want to believe, I don't have to believe that a four-year-old dying with shrapnel in their brains is a price for this. They don't want to have to believe that a four-year-old has to go and drink a gallon of kerosene because he can't get any water in the south of Iraq, that's the price of liberation. They know in their guts that that's wrong. We have to put together the politics and the organization to point to connect that instinct with an analysis and organization that can put forward an alternative.